He had endorsed the inaccurate national intelligence estimate about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. As a manager, Hayden's weakness was that he hated to fire people, so he addressed that by hiring tough deputies. For this and other reasons, he thought of persuading Steve Kappas, the senior operations officer and former Marine who had resigned in protest, to return as deputy CIA director. As soon as Hayden learned that Bush was likely to appoint him, he tracked down Kappas, who was living in London. He called him while Kappas was standing on a platform at Waterloo Station. "Steve, would you consider being the deputy?" Hayden asked. "That would depend on who the director is," Kappas replied. "I'm not at liberty to say, but I'm the one making this call," Hayden hinted. A couple of hours later, Kappas called back and said he was on board. Like many outsiders before him who had arrived in the director's suite on the seventh floor, Hayden had to adjust to the CIA's insular, loose, self-protecting, and hubristic culture. He was dismayed and a little upset the first time he entered a conference room, and none of the CIA officers assembled stood up. His NSA colleagues had stood up for him. Hayden thought to himself, "Well, this will be different." At the eavesdropping agency, the image of Langley was old Yale and patch elbow sleeves and pipes, as a colleague put it. By contrast, the NSA was University of Maryland computer geeks, the worst sort of professional dressing, people in sweatsuits, or even in sweatsuits with torn pants. Soon after Hayden settled in on the seventh floor, senior CIA officers complained to him about the Office of the Inspector General, which was still led by John Helgerson, the career analyst who had resisted the black sites and enhanced interrogation techniques in internal reports. The CIA veterans told Hayden that Helgerson's internal investigations were killing morale around the agency. Hayden asked Robert Dietz, his general counsel, to look into the complaints. It was an awkward assignment. Congress had set up Helgerson's office as an internal watchdog at the CIA. Hayden had no power to remove him. Dietz conducted interviews with senior intelligence officers and presented findings to Helgerson. Essentially, Dietz concluded, the conflict was between the analytical side of the CIA, which Helgerson represented, and the operational side, which took risks in the field and did not appreciate second-guessing. Ultimately, Dietz and Helgerson worked out a classified settlement agreement. It set up a new ombudsman for CIA employees to complain to if they thought the Inspector General was mistreating them, and it required the IG to tape important interviews about alleged misconduct. This was not Hollywood's CIA. It reflected the prosaic reality of office life in the federal government. Another challenge involved the agency's hollowed-out workforce. Freezes and slowdowns in recruitment at the CIA during the 1990s, followed by skyrocketing growth after September 11th, had left Langley by 2006 with graybeards and all these goddamn kids, as the Hayden colleague put it. At the CIA's counterterrorism center, still spread out in the bunker at new headquarters, Hayden inherited Mike D'Andrea, the chain-smoking Muslim convert, as his director. D'Andrea had been promoted to run the center after Rodriguez removed Grenier early in 2006. The budget he oversaw ran into the billions of dollars annually. CTC had become by far the largest organization at the agency. Its new overlord wore dark clothes, was physically unattractive, and treated colleagues harshly. He was regarded as a brilliant operational thinker, as a colleague put it, but if he thought you were his inferior, he'd just crush you. He had no tolerance. If you're really bright, he would nurture you, but he would crush you if you didn't run at his speed. D'Andrea huddled with a handful of fellow smokers outside new headquarters, although he was constantly trying to quit, covering his arms with nicotine patches or chewing nicotine gum. Sometimes he smoked while wearing patches. He worked hard and was reliably at his desk at 8 p.m., flanked by equally devoted mentees. Colleagues compared him half-facetiously to Darth Vader, or, more ominously, as his power grew, to James Angleton, the long-serving, independently powerful counterintelligence chief at the CIA during the Cold War, an intimidating power unto himself. During his first months at Langley, Hayden internalized CTC's battle rhythms, the responsibility to confront that external threat unceasingly, every minute of every hour, as he put it. At CTC, he told the operators and analysts, "Today's date is September 12, 2001. But when he got into his chauffeured CIA car and drove down the GW Parkway to Washington, Hayden reflected, it begins to feel like September 10th. The country was getting comfortable with the threat of terrorism, but anyone who read the threat reporting would worry that they were vulnerable to another big surprise. It was a true fact, Hayden admitted, that the misbegotten war in Iraq had become a cause célèbre for jihadist recruitment, making America, Britain, and other European allies unsafe. Hayden went so far as to describe the evolved Iraq-inflamed conflict with al-Qaeda as a greater danger to Americans than the Cold War, when the United States faced a hair-trigger threat of nuclear annihilation. His logic was stretched, but he meant that, as a practical matter, Americans and Europeans who lived or worked in major cities now faced a realistic prospect of sudden violence, whereas the Cold War's nuclear threats had never materialized. In public, Hayden adamantly defended the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques, targeted killings, and secret renditions of terrorism suspects. Privately, after the journalist Dana Priest and others exposed the black sites and their treatment of prisoners, Hayden moved in tandem with Bush's second-term National Security Cabinet to empty the CIA's secret prisons and transfer the remaining prisoners to Guantanamo. He made no judgment about what his predecessors had done in the post-September 11th emergency. He recognized that the CIA required a broad political consensus to sustain operations over a long period, and that this required accommodating the opposition to torture expressed by influential Republicans like Senator John McCain, who had been tortured as a prisoner of war in Vietnam. Hayden tried to keep the CIA's options open. He declined to repudiate EITs and felt they should remain available in an emergency. But he also sought to assure Congress that CIA operations were on a tighter leash. Still, Hayden insisted the country continued to face an emergency. "For us, it's simply war," he said. At the CIA and the Pentagon, it's a word we use commonly, without ambiguity. He sought to lead an expeditionary campaign to capture or kill those behind the threat. The CIA's leadership would be essential because this was largely an intelligence war, Hayden said. "Our primary adversary is easy to kill," he added. "He's just very hard to find." Part 3. The Best Intentions, 2006 to 2009. Chapter 14. Suicide Detectives. In the late summer of 2006, Brian Glynn Williams, an assistant professor of Islamic history at the University of Massachusetts, was sitting on the back porch of his Davis Square home in Somerville when a contractor for the CIA telephoned. The caller said that analysts at the agency's counterterrorism center were seeking insights from scholars about a wave of suicide bombings remaking the battlefields in Iraq and Afghanistan. Williams agreed to talk further. The CIA's analysts, he soon learned, were puzzling over elemental questions. Why had the targets and use of suicide attacks changed so suddenly? Who were the recruiters, trainers, and financiers? What were the ages and backgrounds of those persuaded to kill themselves? Was there evidence of diffusion or contagion of suicide bombing from Iraq to Afghanistan? The agency wanted a large, multi-country study and hoped independent academics would participate. Williams was intrigued. He spent much of his earlier years in Florida and then made his way into Middle Eastern studies. He spent a semester in the Soviet Union during the 1980s and met soldiers returning from the war in Afghanistan. They told him that the war was nothing but horror. Later, he published histories of Chechnya and Central Asia. Since 2001, he had been drawn into analysis of the Chechen War and the upheavals in Afghanistan. He was 40 years old, but looked younger. He smiled often, displaying perfect white teeth that reflected upon the profession of his Turkish-born wife, a dental hygienist. She was unenthused about the project. "Can't they send someone else?" He agreed that field research for the CIA in Afghanistan might be a little beyond my pay grade, but he found suicide bombing to be repugnant. If he could help reduce it by studying it, he should. There could be no doubt that autumn that suicide bombers had become a newly destabilizing feature of Afghanistan's reviving war. Their increase also represented a departure from Afghanistan's recent military history. During the 1980s, across a long, bitter uprising against the Soviet Union, Afghan Mujahideen had not participated in suicide attacks. The Mujahideen's prideful, family-supported ethos of jihad emphasized individual bravery and, where possible, living to fight another day. When the Taliban conquered Afghanistan during the late 1990s, Mullah Muhammad Omar and his commanders did not employ suicide bombers either. The Arab volunteers who blew themselves up while assassinating Ahmad Shah Massoud belonged to Al-Qaeda. During the 3 years from December 2001 through December 2004, there had been 8 suicide bombings in Afghanistan, all in Kabul. Yet by 2006, suicide bombers struck 2 or 3 times a week around the country, shattering public confidence and forcing Afghan and NATO forces to hunker down behind walls and checkpoints manned by nervous pickets. The Taliban announced their new plan in a policy editorial published in Al Samud, the movement's magazine, in January 2006. "Let the Americans and their allies know that even though we lack equipment, our faith has been unshakable. And with the help of Allah the Almighty, we have created a weapon which you will not be able to face or escape. That is, martyrdom operations. We will follow you everywhere, and we will detonate everything in your face. We will make you terrified, even from vacant lands and silent walls. We know we are inevitably heading towards death, so let it be a glorious death by killing you with us, as we believe in the words of the Prophet, peace be upon him. The heretic and his killer will be united in the fires of hell. We have thus prepared many suicide operations that even will involve women, and we will offer you the taste of perdition in the cities, villages, valleys, and mountains with Allah's help." The most visible spokesman of the Afghan Taliban's suicide initiatives was Dadullah Lang, a one-legged Taliban military commander who bragged about suicide operations on Al Jazeera. He called his young recruits Mullah Omar's missiles and our atomic bombs. He told another interviewer in the summer of 2006, "We like the Al-Qaeda organization. We have close ties and constant contacts. The CIA struggled to provide hard evidence to the National Security Cabinet about why this had evolved so suddenly. The agency offered to buy out Williams's salary at UMass for a semester and to pay an additional $30,000 for his fieldwork and a research paper. He spent the autumn and winter working with a student researcher to build a matrix of suicide attacks in Afghanistan since 2001, to identify patterns and questions that he could examine when he traveled to the country. On his Excel spreadsheet, he recorded dates of suicide bombings, their locations, what category of target had been struck, the number of casualties, and details about the strikes, if they were available from media or other accounts. As his grid of evidence morphed into color-coded, Tetris-like patterns, 2 mysteries presented themselves initially. Williams realized that he was recording a surprising number of zeros in the casualty column, meaning that the suicide attack had failed altogether. There were about 12 such cases in 2006, for example, about 9% of the total. Moreover, the most common outcome of an Afghan suicide attack that year was a single casualty, the bomber himself and no one else. This was not what Williams had seen when he had studied suicide bombings in Iraq. There, failures were abnormal, and high death tolls were common. This led to a second mystery about the Afghan pattern, concerning the bomber's targets. In Iraq, suicide bombers typically struck crowds of civilians to sow terror by inflicting mass casualties, including women and children. The context for these attacks was often sectarian. Al-Qaeda-influenced Sunni suicide bombers struck Shiite civilian marketplaces or mosques, and vice versa. In Afghanistan, however, suicide bombers most often struck military targets, such as heavily armed American or NATO convoys moving on roadways. Remarkably often, only the bomber died. Williams and his researcher chuckled morbidly about how incompetent some of these suicide bombers seemed to be. One had strapped on his vest, traveled to say goodbye to his parents, and accidentally detonated his device during the visit, taking his own life and theirs. But when Williams reflected on it, the pattern seemed tragic. Presumably, such failures indicated how many suicide bombers recruited to die in Afghanistan might be coerced, naive, illiterate, young, or disabled. The CIA's contractor and an analyst at the agency's counterterrorism center arranged for Williams to travel to Afghanistan. He departed in the early spring of 2007. Williams connected with Hekmat Karzai, a cousin of the Afghan president who ran a Kabul think tank. He provided Williams with a base of operations in Kabul. As to the risks he would take traveling to provinces to meet local police, investigate bombing case files, and speak with affected Afghans, he was largely on his own. His CIA supervisors told him, "If you get caught, we don't know you." He wasn't sure how serious they were, but their instructions were clear. "We appreciate your service, but don't call us." The CIA's suicide bombing study coincided with a renewed stirring of interest in the Afghan war at the White House. The Afghan Interagency Operations Group at the National Security Council remained the main vehicle for policy and budget decisions. The group was bureaucratically weak and often ignored. John Gasfried of the State Department co-chaired the effort. His modest rank, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, signaled his operations' low standing in the Bush-Cheney-Rumsfeld hierarchy, an apparatus focused almost entirely on the worsening war in Iraq. Yet at least Gasfried's group was organized across government to think about what American policy in Afghanistan required, a change from several years before. "We ought to take a look at where we are and what we're doing," Gasfried announced one afternoon in mid-2006 at the State Department, where the operations group met. In Kabul, Ronald Newman had succeeded Zalmay Khalilzad as U.S. ambassador. Gasfried would arrive at Foggy Bottom around 6:30 a.m., and the first thing he did was call Newman. They agreed the levels of aid to the country were grossly inadequate, and that the U.S. military needed to mount a bigger effort to prevent the war's further deterioration. They also knew that to persuade President Bush and the Office of Management and Budget to change course and spend more in the midst of the treasury-draining fiasco in Iraq would require a formal policy review. Megan O'Sullivan, the senior National Security Council advisor who worked mainly on Iraq but also kept track of Afghanistan, brought the idea for a review to Bush, who approved it. Newman had tried with little success to persuade the State Department and the White House to radically increase investments in Afghanistan. He regarded the plan for a new policy review with skepticism. "Searching for a new strategy seems to be policymakers' recurring default reaction to problems," as he put it. Instead of properly resourcing the strategy the administration already possessed, it authorized a search for a new idea. Certainly ideas are more easily come by than money and soldiers. In the autumn of 2006, Gasfried and his co-chair, Tony Harriman, the NSC senior director for Afghanistan, commissioned classified study papers on every major policy subject that seemed relevant: the Afghan justice system, the police, narcotics, the Afghan National Army, and civilian aid. The final drafts of these papers contained recommendations. In essence, they identified the need for more resources, more spending. Harriman liked to point out to his colleagues that there were more combat aircraft controlled by the State Department operating in Colombia to support the fight against coca-growing and Marxist guerrillas there than there were combat aircraft controlled by the Pentagon in Afghanistan. "We cannot win in Afghanistan on the cheap," Newman wrote to Washington. Michael Waltz, the Special Forces officer, rotated from Afghanistan to a policy position at the Pentagon late that year. He was pleased to find some growing awareness of the worsening situation in Afghanistan, yet many of the Afghan hands he encountered were increasingly frustrated. "Even though our senior leaders recognized the growing problem, the default response was to turn to the Europeans to do more." The American electorate soon came to the aid of their cause. In early November 2006, in midterm elections, voters repudiated President Bush and handed control of Congress to the Democrats. Bush accepted Rumsfeld's resignation in the aftermath and appointed Robert Gates as Secretary of Defense. Gates had been at the CIA and the White House when the United States abandoned Afghanistan in the early 1990s. He was determined not to preside over another failure in South Asia, yet he was skeptical that the United States could fix the war. His historical perspective screamed for caution, yet American generals in the field insisted they needed more forces and resources. On November 13, 2006, the NSC forwarded to President Bush a 10-page classified executive summary of the Afghanistan Strategic Review. Bush approved its findings on December 10th. The plan called for more money, a re-energized effort to improve security and governance, a new push to undermine the booming drug economy, and more American troops on the ground. The hypothesis of the paper promoted the need to connect the Afghan people to their government. They proposed more schools, roads, and electricity. Of these recommendations, only the call for more American troops failed to materialize quickly. Early in 2007, Bush's decision to authorize a surge of troops into Baghdad under the command of General David Petraeus effectively used up all of the Pentagon's available personnel, and then some. With about 150,000 American troops now in Iraq, there were no additional units available for Afghanistan. The Afghan review did reverse the administration's parsimony about reconstruction aid. Now the OMB approved a supplemental allocation to Afghanistan of more than $1 billion. Although to Newman's disappointment, the White House split the funding across two fiscal years, diluting its impact. The ambassador got pretty cranky, as Gastright put it, and cabled in protest, but the decision stood. The Bush administration's total spending on security in Afghanistan would, nonetheless, be greater during 2007 than during all previous years combined. The allocations included major new classified investments at Amrullah Saleh's NDS for the Afghan National Army and for the police. Paul Miller, the CIA analyst who moved to the White House that year to work on Afghanistan, estimated that total security assistance, classified and unclassified, ballooned toward almost $8 billion a year, at least four times the levels of the Mr. Big era when Khalilzad was ambassador in Kabul. In February 2007, Bush appeared at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington to speak about the global war on terror. He gave over much of his speech to Iraq, but about halfway through his talk, he disclosed that his administration had just finished a top-to-bottom review of our strategy in Afghanistan. Bush laid out renewed aims: to help the people of that country to defeat the terrorists and establish a stable, moderate, and democratic state that respects the rights of its citizens, governs its territory effectively, and is a reliable ally in this war against extremists and terrorists. He admitted, "Oh, for some that may seem like an impossible task, but it's not impossible." In fact, the war on the ground was deteriorating by the month. Its challenges had at last attracted the White House's attention. Yet the Bush administration's new strategy to stabilize the country remained informed by undue optimism, not least because Afghanistan still looked much better than Iraq. Bush was defensive about the comparison. He told the Joint Chiefs, "Many in Congress don't understand the military. Afghanistan is good, Iraq is bad. Bullshit." In the parking lot of the Kabul International Airport, Brian Williams met Humayun, the tall driver come bodyguard with whom he would work for the next 2 months. He was from Kandahar. He mentioned that he had not told his family about his work with the Karzai regime in Kabul, as this would only attract the Taliban's ire. He kept a pistol in his car. He told Williams that he appreciated what the United States was trying to do in Afghanistan. "The day you leave, the Taliban will be back," he predicted. Williams settled into a room in Hekmat Karzai's walled compound. Each morning he descended to the common area for tea, naan, and cheese, and to check for news of the latest suicide bombings. If possible, he and Humayun would drive out to crime scenes. Sometimes they arrived when there was still blood on the ground. 5 days after he arrived, Williams drove to meet U.S. Army officers at Bagram Airfield. He was stunned by the self-imposed isolation of the American soldiers and military intelligence officers he met. By 2006, Bagram had acquired some of the amenities common on other American military bases worldwide. There was a bowling alley, a Burger King, and an Orange Julius, Williams discovered. He learned nothing from his meetings, except that the American officers knew nothing about why the rise of suicide warfare had occurred or where it was heading. The officers he met seemed to consider everything beyond their barrier to be a red zone. At NDS headquarters, Williams met Amrullah Saleh's staff and several of his senior officers. They were much better informed. They had a theory of how suicide bombings had accelerated. Their insights were derived mainly from arrests and interrogations. The Iraq War was one factor, they told Williams. Arab technicians fashioning suicide vests and vehicle bombs in Iraq were highly sophisticated in comparison to the typically illiterate Pashtun commanders of the Taliban. The international jihadists were trying to export their suicide bomb technology to Afghanistan, but with mixed results. In Nimruz, a large province in the southwest, NDS had arrested several Arabs crossing from Iran who were transporting prefabricated suicide belts for the Taliban. NDS believed the majority of bombers striking inside Afghanistan were Pashtuns from the federally administered tribal areas of Pakistan. Security officers at the United Nations, who were responsible for the safety of development and political officers scattered around Afghanistan, handed Williams a PowerPoint deck showing about 50 photographs of the severed heads of deceased bombers. There could have been a touch of dubious phrenology in the United Nations analysis of the pictures of the heads, a confidence about what the contours of the faces showed about the bombers' ethnic or national origins that would not pass as science. But the photos did make clear that the bombers were all very young. To Williams, they appeared to be Pashtuns, not Arabs. As he picked through the case files, Williams slowly developed a composite picture of a typical suicide bomber in Afghanistan. The Taliban bombers were often young, as young as 12 or 13. They typically had little experience at driving, never mind at speed racing along roads in a battered bomb-rigged Toyota Corolla. Under pressure, in the last seconds of their immature lives, they failed. Police officers summarizing interrogations of detainees in NDS custody explained that the Taliban paid the families of suicide bombers in the range of $2,000 to $10,000, a small fortune in Waziristan or the rural south and east of Afghanistan. The boys were recruited from madrasas, where they had been enrolled for years in a curriculum of suffocating political religious instruction. In Pakistan, during the first half of 2007, separately from Williams's inquiries, Pakistan Army officers, psychologists, and social scientists confronted a parallel rise in suicide bombings against Pakistani targets. These attacks, too, emanated from Waziristan. A fusion of Al-Qaeda, Afghan Taliban, Pakistani Taliban, and Punjabi radicals had turned against the Pakistani state and ISI itself on the grounds that it had betrayed Islam through alliance with the United States. Abu Bakr Amin Bajwa, a Pakistani brigadier posted to Waziristan, stumbled into an abandoned Taliban suicide bomber school while on patrol. In Razmak, a district of North Waziristan near the Afghan border, where Arab Al-Qaeda units had embedded, he visited a Jannat, or paradise facility for suicide bombers, in the final stages of preparations. The recruits studied in concrete rooms whose walls were painted with murals of the afterlife, channels of milk and honey, fruit trees, green mountains, streetlights, and animals like camels and horses. Another room depicted paintings of virgin girls. One of the young women was shown filling a water jug at a pond. The faces of the virgins and the animals had been crudely brushed out in keeping with Taliban prescriptions against living figures in art. On the walls of the final room, Bajwa saw the names of suicide bombers who had fulfilled their missions, written in blood. Across the way, he found a water tank where the Taliban used to execute or torture the people who would oppose them or spy on them. Family finances, enticements of paradise, and torture created an environment that no 13-year-old boy was likely to withstand independently. Bajwa discovered further that the boys were injected daily with the anti-anxiety medicines Valium and Xanax and weekly with Pendimethalin, an analgesic. Trainers preferred boys who were either seriously ill, mentally challenged, or else had a reason for revenge, such as a family member killed in military operations. Bombers typically operated in pairs, monitored by their trainers. Those known to be suffering from mental illness or paralysis could be remotely detonated. Shahzadi Beg, a British barrister who had worked on programs to rehabilitate such boys in Pakistan after they were captured by authorities, encountered a 14-year-old in a Pakistani jail. He had been arrested after a failed suicide attack. The boy was shackled by the ankles and handcuffed. His eyes darted around the room. Beg asked what he was looking at. "I'm trying to see if there is something I can kill you with," he answered. The boy had been recruited from his family in South Waziristan, but said he did not want to see them again. He had been arrested at an army checkpoint, wearing a suicide jacket, just 2 hours from his home. It was the first time he had ever left his village. "I am in dishonor. I failed in what I was supposed to do." He said that if he was released, he would complete his mission. His eyes brimmed with tears when Beg asked if he missed his mother, but he tried very hard not to show emotion, and said that his mission was to kill unbelievers. He refused to watch television because he believed it was the devil's instrument and designed to deceive him. He had memorized the Quran, yet could not translate the meaning of any verses from Arabic to Urdu or Pashto. Psychiatrists who counseled former suicide bomber recruits in Pakistan found that the kids were bullied, assigned menial tasks, and beaten if they did not accomplish them. They were provided marijuana as a reward. They adapted. They had no alternative. The images of afterlife at the bomber school in Razmak, horses and virgins filling water pots from a pond, suggested how Taliban commanders had refined Al-Qaeda's ideology to communicate with rural Pashtun communities. To Brian Williams, this helped to explain why so many Afghan Taliban suicide operations targeted armored military convoys or armed guards at the perimeter of walled security bases, rather than marketplaces, mosques, or other soft targets, where they might kill many more people and sow terror, even if their victims were civilians. During 2006 and 2007, Taliban suicide bombers did attack civilians in settings such as dogfights, where gambling took place, but they did not often follow the Iraqi or Pakistani sectarian pattern of killing large numbers of civilians deliberately. To maintain legitimacy among Pashtun families sacrificing sons, The suicide operations had to be honorable. It was acceptable to die in an attempted military attack on a UN convoy, even if the attack was difficult. It was not as honorable to blow up pious Afghan Muslims in a bazaar. This pattern would dissolve in the years to come, particularly as ISI and the Haqqani network sought to destabilize Kabul, and as sectarian feeling hardened in the intensifying war. But at the beginning of the suicide bombing wave, Williams's research showed the recruits and their families seemed to require a traditional military purpose. As Williams completed his research, the number of Afghan suicide bombers who changed their minds at the last minute also impressed him. Afghan police showed him suicide vests that boys had torn off, dropped, and run away from. By now, Williams empathized with the bombers and felt he understood their ambivalence. They really believed in the righteousness of their struggle. The attacks of September 11th meant nothing to them or their families. They did not even have televisions. The families that accepted payment for their sacrifice and glorified their martyrdom really believe in the Taliban and believe in the war and the goodness of it, Williams reflected. Yet suicide bombing should not be understood as an indigenous aspect of the Taliban's revival, he concluded. In Gardez, he found DVDs stacked for sale in a market. They were designed to inspire suicide bombers. The programs were Iraqi productions, originally produced in Arabic, but dubbed in Pashto for the Afghan market. They presented calls to martyrdom amid nahids, or Islamic vocal works. This was the clearest evidence Williams had yet encountered of the Iraq effect. In fact, the number of suicide bombings in Afghanistan declined in the years after Williams' study, while the number of landmine or improvised explosive device attacks increased more than sixfold. As NATO and the UN imported armored vehicles and took greater precautions, powerful landmines were a more effective tactical counter for the Taliban. Suicide bombings constituted about 4% of all Taliban bombings in 2007. 3 years later, they constituted less than 1%, although the number of assassinations and mass casualty attacks against civilians increased. Williams felt more convinced than ever before of the rightness of the U.S. going into Afghanistan, that the U.S. need to be there to fight off the Taliban, as he put it. Yet his support was tempered by his shock at how badly the war was going. Back home, he wrote up classified and unclassified versions of his findings. Because he did not yet have a top-secret security clearance, once he turned in the classified paper, he wasn't allowed to look at it again. Williams presented his findings to analysts at the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. The contractor who had recruited him to do the study also asked him to a conference at a Virginia hotel to present his work to about 80 CIA, military, and other intelligence analysts. "I don't think this is organic to Afghanistan," Williams told them. The CIA analysts he encountered accepted that, but those from the Defense Intelligence Agency challenged him. The back and forth went on for 10 minutes. "How do you know suicide bombing did not evolve intrinsically from Afghan culture?" the more skeptical analysts asked. "Well," Williams said, all he could say was that the pattern of attacks he had documented showed that Taliban suicide squads were made up of poorly qualified, often coerced youngsters. Many in his audience didn't like his overall conclusion, which was, the Iraq War had destabilized the Afghan War. Chapter 15. Plan Afghanistan. During the first few years after the Taliban's fall from power, opium poppy cultivation in Afghanistan rose by about a quarter. During 2006, it boomed. Afghan farmers planted just over 400,000 acres in poppy, the most ever measured, enough to manufacture just over 90% of the world's annual heroin supply. More than 3 million Afghans, about 14% of the population, by now participated in the drug economy, according to the United Nations. Afghan farmers might earn just over $30 planting an acre of wheat, but more than $500 for poppy. The total export volume of opium and derived products like morphine was about $4 billion, or just over half the size of the legal Afghan economy. It was hard to say how many Afghans participated in those export profits, yet they certainly benefited from the farm gate price for poppy of about $1 billion, which was more than 10% of the economy. More than half of the poppy crop grew in the irrigated river belts of Helmand and Kandahar, the Taliban heartland. George W. Bush had served 8 years as a border state governor in Texas and knew how drug syndicates had destabilized Mexico and Colombia. The fact that the Taliban's revival as a fighting force in 2006 coincided with an opium boom attracted Bush's attention. The National Security Council had earlier asked the Drug Enforcement Administration's intelligence division to produce a study comparing the Taliban with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, a leftist insurgent movement funded in part by Colombia's cocaine economy. In the circumstances, this was a sort of intelligence study where both the commissioning party, the White House, and the analysts assigned knew roughly what the findings would be. It would have been surprising if the DEA had reported back to the White House that the Taliban were not like the FARC or that drugs figured little in their military resurgence. Supervision of the assignment had fallen to Michael Brown, a career DEA officer and administrator who had built up the agency's presence in Afghanistan. He served as director of the DEA's Office of Special Intelligence until early 2005, when he became chief of operations. Earlier in his career, Braun had deployed abroad for 7 years in Operation Snowcap, the Reagan-era paramilitary program in which special forces trained DEA agents embedded with Bolivian, Peruvian, and Colombian police and military forces to attack Andean coca labs and traffickers. In the early 1990s, he had seen up close how the FARC and Peru's shining path-Marxist guerrillas operated. The DEA study about Afghanistan took note of recent academic work on the causes of civil wars. The Stanford University political scientists James Fearon and David D. Layton had published influential studies in 2003 and 2004. They coded and analyzed scores of civil wars fought between 1945 and 1999. One of their most striking findings was that civil wars were getting longer. In the late 1940s, many internal conflicts lasted only 2 years, whereas by 1999, they lasted 16 years on average. Fearon's analysis also showed that self-funding guerrilla groups with direct access to drug profits fight for unusually long periods, up to 30 or 40 years. The FARC, for example, had been battling the Colombian state since 1964. Now the Taliban were going down the same path, Braun concluded. Reporting from the DEA office in Kabul showed that Taliban commanders had shifted from providing protection services to morphine labs in Afghanistan to actually running labs. To Braun, that made sense, because it was similar to what Marxist groups in Latin America had done after they lost Soviet subsidies. Here, the Taliban were also adapting to the loss of official subsidies. During the 1990s, the Taliban had received open support from Pakistan and Gulf states. Now the pressure on Pakistan not to get caught providing aid to the Taliban had forced the movement into greater financial self-reliance. Heroin was part of the Taliban's solution, Braun believed. And since infidels in Europe consumed most of Afghanistan's heroin, Taliban ideologists could rationalize their participation in the trade. The Bush administration had not previously linked war strategy in Afghanistan with drug policy. Mary Beth Long, an attorney, was the top Pentagon official in charge of counter-narcotics policy. When she arrived in 2004, she discovered that the Pentagon's leadership, military and civilian, were not interested in suppressing opium poppy planting in Afghanistan. Some Pentagon officials asserted that they did not have authority under American law to conduct aggressive anti-drug campaigns outside Colombia, even if they wished to do so. Long developed a plan to clarify that the Army could indeed use our authorities like the authorities that we have in Colombia, in Helmand and Kandahar. But it wasn't clear to her that anyone outside of the DEA wanted to militarize the fight against opium in Afghanistan. A staffer for General David Barno, the commander in Afghanistan during Zalmay Khalilzad's tour as ambassador, accused Long of trying to do a Cheney on them by using argumentative intelligence to expand the war's scope. In addition, it hardly needed pointing out that American policy after 2002 empowered warlords with ties to the drug trade from north to south. The Pentagon and the CIA worked with the worst of the worst, and they didn't care what these guys did on the side, as Doug Wankel, a DEA agent who served in the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, put it. That's just a fact. A fierce argument erupted among U.S. intelligence agencies about whether opium and heroin were, in fact, a significant aspect of the Taliban's insurgency. The argument would go on inside classified conference rooms for several years. Analysts at DIA discounted Braun's initial study comparing the Taliban with the FARC. There was no consensus on the basic question, namely, whether opium money was an indispensable growing source of finance for the Taliban. Data about drugs and Taliban finance was inherently sketchy and often inferred from scattered criminal cases and detainee testimony. A few key points were well established. The Taliban imposed two religious taxes, usher and zakat, on the opium economy. The taxes hit farmers, truckers, morphine makers, and smugglers. The tax rates were 10 and 20%, prescribed by the Quran, and so not subject to change. Therefore, as opium growing boomed in the South in 2006 and 2007, it was logical to conclude that the Taliban's coffers had also swelled. But how much money did the Taliban really earn? The movement did not have Swiss bank accounts that could be hacked and analyzed. If the Taliban imposed usher and zakat taxes on the $4 billion estimated export value of the 2006 opium crop, then it might earn upwards of $500 million annually from drug trafficking, DEA studies estimated. That would be a huge sum for a guerrilla force of the Taliban scale. But what evidence was there that the Taliban could tax the full $4 billion in revenue? Wasn't it more likely that they could access only the farm gate crop of about $1 billion? In that case, their take might be $100 million. When the DEA's analysts first circulated its $500 million estimate, DIA analysts challenged their assumptions. The debates frustrated those like John Walters, the White House drug czar, who felt the agencies were deliberately shading analysis to support their preferred policies. Those analysts who doubted the DEA emphasized that the Taliban had many other sources of income besides drug taxes. They also taxed other forms of smuggling, and they had long-standing business and preaching networks in Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and other Gulf countries. And, of course, they enjoyed sanctuary in Pakistan. Why should the United States distort its already overstretched war strategy to attack one source of Taliban and Al-Qaeda finance without making an equal effort to choke off the other income sources or to eliminate the Pakistani sanctuary? At the Pentagon, Mary Beth Long fought back by producing dossiers of evidence showing that American troops were tripping across narcotics in the same places where they were finding weapons caches in Taliban strongholds. Analysts at DIA told her she was factually wrong. CIA analysts were less vocal but made their opposition clear. The main pushback came from the Army and Central Command. Long wasn't sure why the uniformed services were so adamant, but she concluded that they just did not want to see a linkage between drug revenue and the Taliban's return because it would complicate their mission. Long created more dossiers of evidence showing caches of narcotics discovered on the Afghan battlefield alongside rocket-propelled grenades and improvised explosive devices. She briefed members of Congress and was eventually able to present to President Bush and the Principals Committee in the Situation Room. She tried to convince them about the perils of allowing the opium trade to run unaddressed. At the White House, Long was pushing on an open door. With her evidence, along with the analysis of Braun and others at DEA and at the State Department, the idea took hold in the Bush administration that the model for fixing Afghanistan was in Colombia. The long American effort there to strengthen the state, defeat drug traffickers, and isolate Marxist guerrillas was known as Plan Colombia. The Clinton administration had conceived Plan Colombia in 1998. The Bush administration had embraced and advanced it, aligning closely with President Alvaro Uribe Vélez, a conservative. The plan's elements included aerial spraying of coca fields, crop eradication by Colombian forces on the ground, American security and intelligence support for military and police, exports of helicopters, aircraft, weapons, eavesdropping equipment, and other gear, and staunch political backing for the elected government in Bogota. As with all things in Afghanistan, however, ambition outstripped means. On January 24, 2007, General Dan McNeil, the newly appointed commander of NATO forces battling the Taliban, met George W. Bush in the Oval Office. After a few minutes of picture-taking and question-shouting from journalists, the two men were alone. "Tell me what you think you can do," Bush said. "First on my list is to get the Europeans outside the wire and into the fight," McNeil answered. "You need to do this," Bush agreed. He told McNeil that they would speak regularly, and that the president would ask from time to time what equipment or additional troops the general needed to fulfill his mission. "And you have to tell me," Bush said. "Don't worry what anyone else thinks." He warned McNeil, however, "I've got to take care of this Iraq thing first." That same week, Bush convened a National Security Council meeting about the exploding poppy problem in Afghanistan. The president wanted more effort on eradication. He appointed a new ambassador-level State Department coordinator on drugs and corruption in Afghanistan, Tom Schweik, and he directed the White House drug policy czar, John Walters, to get more actively involved. The Pentagon, State, DEA, and CIA were all to be part of a new counter-narcotics and poppy eradication effort, even though each of these agencies harbored different views about the wisdom of poppy eradication in Afghanistan. Before their differences were resolved, money began to flow. Congress allocated more than $1 billion to overt counter-narcotics policy in Afghanistan for the 2 years between October 2006 and October 2008. Bush's adaptation of Plan Colombia for Afghanistan constituted the most significant change in U.S. policy in the war since 2002. Yet in early 2007, the Iraq War dominated media coverage, and the change was not clearly visible to the public. Bush's intentions were hardly disguised, however. As the new ambassador to Kabul, the president nominated William Wood, a career foreign officer who had served as the U.S. ambassador to Colombia since 2003. As the new ambassador to Pakistan, Bush nominated Ann Patterson, who had been Wood's predecessor in Bogota. For the next several years, the two most important American diplomats in South Asia would be career officers who had spent years fighting Colombia's cocaine cartels and Marxist insurgents under the premises of Plan Colombia. The most dramatic aspect of Plan Colombia was the aerial spraying of coca crops with herbicide. In late 2006 and early 2007, for Afghanistan, Bush advocated strongly for spraying poppy crops from airplanes in the heart of Taliban country. He repeatedly told John Walters, "You have got to spray. I'm a spray guy." One reason there was little debate in Washington about Bush's turn in Afghan policy was that leading Democrats backed the president's new priorities. On January 28, 2007, the same week as the urgent cabinet meeting on the opium problem, newly elected Speaker of the House of Representatives Nancy Pelosi led a Democratic congressional delegation to Kabul to meet Karzai. They talked mainly about Pakistan and poppy. On drug eradication, the Democrats told Karzai flatly, future U.S. aid to Afghanistan could erode if poppy cultivation was not brought under control. Karzai admitted it was a deep problem and promised that his government would eradicate as much poppy as it could. William Wood landed in Kabul that spring. No longer did American ambassadors live in cramped trailer parks. The same construction boom that had brought Orange Julius to Bagram Airfield had delivered a new high-rise apartment building for diplomats. It rose next to a large, barricaded, modernized embassy building. As Condoleezza Rice put it, the big, ugly building sent the message that, for better or worse, we were in Afghanistan for the long run. The ambassador's residence now constituted a penthouse on the high-rise's top floor, with an outdoor veranda offering dramatic views of the Kabul skyline. Wood was a tall man who fired off one-liners and enjoyed the occasional cigarette and scotch on the rocks, as the ambassador's British counterpart, Sherard Cooper Coles, put it. He enjoyed history and English literature, especially P.G. Wodehouse. Wood arrived in Kabul with every reason to believe that the White House's plan to spray Afghanistan's poppy fields would work. During 2006, his final year as ambassador to Colombia, aerial coca crop eradication had reached its apex. American-supplied aircraft sprayed glyphosate, an herbicide sold commercially under the brand name Roundup, on 400,000 acres of Colombian coca, the most ever destroyed from above. The Colombian government declared a triumph. Wood's message was, it worked okay in Colombia, but it should work really well in Afghanistan, because the terrain in Kandahar and Helmand was flat, and the poppy crop was tightly packed in a few green belts irrigated by rivers. A few spray planes and armed helicopters could swoop north to south over the Helmand Valley, wiping out hundreds of millions of dollars worth of poppy. If people would just come to their senses, we could eliminate this problem in 3 weeks, Wood told Tom Schweik, who agreed with him. Spraying would affect British forces deployed to Helmand. Wood sought an ally in the new British ambassador to Kabul, Cooper Coles. He invited him one evening for drinks on his veranda. Looking over the parapet, through the dust-filled night at the uncertain flickering of Kabul's lights, Wood laid out his vision. To Cooper Coles, it conjured up the Robert Duvall scenes in Apocalypse Now. Wood hoped to wipe out poppy fields in Helmand and Kandahar before the end of 2007. Cooper Coles feared crop dusting in the Taliban heartland might risk turning an insurgency into an insurrection. The British ambassador dubbed Wood Chemical Bill, a moniker that stuck. There was another way to consider the problem of drugs and the Taliban. Perhaps it was not mainly that opium caused war. Perhaps it was war that caused opium. Afghan farmers had grown poppy crops for centuries. But it was not until the Soviet invasion and the scorched earth civil wars that followed that the opium economy grew to such scale. The fighting destroyed irrigation systems, leveled the cities, cratered the roads, blasted the schools. As a British-funded report written for the Karzai government put it, half of all farms were abandoned. The state collapsed in many rural areas. In these dire conditions, Afghan farmers turned to opium production to survive. The returns per acre were higher, the crop was unusually weatherproof, and it did not require elaborate storage or marketing. An opium crop could be raised in just 6 months and stored as a form of savings. This was also Karzai's explanation about the spread of poppy across his native Kandahar. After the Soviet invasion, there was complete despair, he told an American television audience in 2006. No Afghan family was sure if they were going to have their house the next day. They needed ready cash. So Poppy came to Afghanistan out of an extreme desperation.